Hello and welcome once again to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I'm your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me, as always, are Bob Novella.
Good evening, everyone.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
And Perry DeAngelis.
Hey, how is everyone tonight?
So, Bob, you sent me an interesting item that you found on eBay last week. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was a great one. It was interesting, and it also got me a little upset. What it was it's an auction, an eBay auction, for a haunted doll. And so this guy had this big blurb on the auction saying things that, I've been a paranormal investigator for 20 years. In the last 4 years, I have, and these are quotes, I have mainly studied inanimate objects, mostly dolls. All right, now, so this guy plays with dolls a lot. That tells you one thing.
That's his specialty, haunted dolls.
If a house could be
dolls
haunted.
Dolls are good because they have faces, and they're like little people, and they're very emotional.
And you can sell them on eBay.
Right.
That's what dolls
well,
are good.
He says, if a house can be haunted, why not a doll? Okay. So he goes on, there's only 3 documented haunted dolls out there in paranormal community. Now, I thought there was only 2, but he's telling me there's 3. Vincent the Haunted Clown Doll, Annabelle the Haunted Raggedy Ann Doll, and Robert the Haunted Doll from Key West, Florida.
Okay. Where did they get these names from?
I guess in the paranormal community, that's kind of a well-known thing. If you're
is that
into
like
dolls.
Naming hurricanes?
So, but his doll is named Megan.
Okay.
And it looked like an average, you know, well-made doll to me. And so he's saying that, oh, Megan was very interesting and he felt something odd about her. I don't know what it was, but a presence was definitely there. Well, that's what he tried to write. He actually wrote a presence as an ENTS was defiantly there. So I can only assume he meant presence was definitely there. So he doesn't have spell check, apparently. Let's see. What first got my attention was that he would sit her up, and then she would always end up on her side. Well, that sounds pretty wacky to me, dolls falling over. So he decided to tape it. He videotaped it one night. He left the tape running, and he reassures everyone that no one was in the room during the time of the recording. He makes a point of stressing that. And he shows the video, and it was an MPEG. And at first blush, just looking at the MPEG quickly, you're like, okay, the doll moved its head. It kind of tilted its head up and turned it slightly to its left. But I looked at the video a few times, and I got real close to it. Now, to my untrained eye, there was definitely something a little unusual about the movement of the doll. It seemed like there was a little distortion, possibly even some sort of, a stop-motion effect where it moved, he'd stop the camera or something.
Didn't seem kosher, huh?
It just didn't seem kosher to me. And, of course, he had the timer, you know, the time counting up as it was filming. But, of course, that's an easy thing to fake, assuming that this whole thing was fake.
Bob, you don't believe this guy?
What are you talking about?
Well, I didn't believe it. I didn't believe it until the clincher. Of course, at the end, he hits us with, I have studied Megan with EMF, electromagnetic frequency meters, and have gotten strong hits from her. Well, of course, that convinced me. I mean, if an EMF meter is going crazy, well, what other evidence do you need?
Yeah, it has to be haunted.
So after all this, last time I checked, he got over 40 bids, and it went for over $610.
A $10 doll, basically.
Right, this is a $10 doll. And he got now the auction's over. Now Perry, you saw the auction end. It went for $610 or something.
Yes, it did. $610. It was the final bid. Yeah.
Now since the auction ended, I've tried to find it in the archive, and it's not listed anymore. Now I really wanted to write a letter and send it to eBay saying, hey, I mean this is fraud.
Well, Bob, that's not a problem. There are currently 114 haunted dolls for sale on eBay.
Okay.
If you
do a
search on haunted doll, you'll come up with 114 of them.
But Perry, there's only 3 legitimate ones in the world.
These would be the illegitimate ones.
Well, right. These have names. I guess the other ones don't.
Still won't get that. You know, many of them with a lot of dramatic photos, a lot of ghost orbs here, a lot of blurry images, a lot of lens flash, a lot of camera cords.
I thought eBay was good with fraud, but I guess this kind of fringe thing is kind of hard. You know, hard to enforce. I mean, it's easy to determine that yes, this Monet painting is indeed a fake, but how do you conclusively prove that?
Right.
You know, it's like proving a negative. You can't prove that this doll did not move at this point in time.
Well, Bob, that's the whole point of the evidence. I mean, they have photos of the dolls,
right,
like sitting and have blurry, you know, flashes and blobs around them.
Evan, if I got my hands on that MPEG, I wonder if you guys would be able to scrutinize it at work.
Yeah, send it over. We'll see what we can make of it.
Yeah. Now, I mean, with most of these dolls, it's let the buyer beware, right? I mean, if you want to buy something because somebody else says it's, you know, haunted, that's your problem. But if somebody doctored up a video, yeah, at least you can make the case that that was a conscious,
right,
deliberate deception. If he was using that to sort of establish a value, right, for the object, that doesn't have.
Yeah, eBay's not in the business of debunking the claims of what the people are trying to sell.
I mean, they try and not have outrageous fraud. But
of course.
Here's a doll that actually was able to issue some EVPs. That
electronic voice phenomenon, huh?
Yeah.
It was a talking doll. Gee, I've never seen that before.
you know where I've been getting the strangest EVPs from? This light in the house. When I bring the meter close to that light, it goes off the chart. That light must be haunted.
EVP is electronic voice phenomenon, not an EM meter. EM meter
right.
Would be a different phenomenon.
He says that I capture three voices on the recorder very briefly. We believe one says, now. Then we believe one says, want to play some music? There is also some rustling noise, and I think a door slamming. Then you hear some more rustling, and a voice saying simply, hello. That's what he got on his EVP.
There you go.
From this doll, from this picture, this haunted doll. And you should see, I mean, in this particular doll, which is simply, the auction is entitled Haunted Doll EVP, there's a huge burst of light near the doll. I mean, in fact, it looks like it's right on the lens. It's incredible. I mean, it's very impressive.
So we actually had the privilege of seeing a haunted doll before. You guys remember this? We were in the most haunted location in the world.
It was one of the three that he mentioned, Steve.
Ed Warren's basement, right.
That must have been the Raggedy Ann doll.
It was luckily for our protection, it was locked behind a glass case.
It was.
And we were warned not to taunt it. The last person did that died in a motorcycle accident leaving the museum. So we were very careful to taunt it as much as we possibly could.
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember Ed saying that don't touch anything in the basement, because just touching anything, you know, you could, I don't know, get possessed
or
whatever.
But Bob, if you did do it by accident, he had the cleansing ritual.
Right, yes, but of course, I didn't do it by accident. I touched everything I possibly could when he wasn't looking.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm still alive, what, 10 years? Five years later?
It's been about six years, I think.
So, I mean, every day is just a bonus for me, you know? God.
That's true. You're living on borrowed time, Bob.
Well, later in the show, in a few minutes, we're going to have Steve Salerno on, the author of a book called Sham, about the self-help and actualization movement. But before that, we're going to do this week's Science or Fiction.
It's time to play Science or Fiction.
So here are the three items for this week.
How does this work, Steve?
Well, I'll tell you. Every week, I scour the news and the internet for interesting items, either science news items or science trivia facts. I present two facts which are real, and one I've made up. The challenge for my panel of skeptics, Bob, Evan, and Perry, is to sniff out which one is fake and from the two that are real. Are you guys ready?
Indeed.
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's
Born
play.
Ready.
So listen to all three before you make your guess. Number one. Scientists in Hawaii have discovered a new species of carnivorous caterpillar. Item number two. Paleoanthropologists have discovered the first evidence of Neanderthal man in North America. Or item number three. Scientists have published the results of a key experiment demonstrating desktop cold fusion. Which two of those are real recent news items, science news items, and which one is the fake science news item?
Cold fusion's fake.
Repeat that last one, Steve.
Go ahead.
So, Perry, you're going to confidently vote for number three, that the desktop Cold Fusion is the fake.
Is it? Well, it's absolutely fake.
Well, this, I mean, it sounds almost too easy to choose,
I would have heard
to choose the third
that's,
one. To choose the
my
third
bottom
one.
Line is I would have heard about it. I didn't hear about it. It's fake. Carnivorous caterpillars? Sure. Neanderthals in North America? Sure. Look at some
Why
of our
not?
Politicians. But Cold Fusion on a desktop? No. No way.
Okay, Evan, you concur?
I have to concur, but I won't be surprised if I'm wrong, but I'll concur.
we're never surprised if you're wrong, Perry.
No.
Thank you. I was right last week. Go ahead.
I thought we're going to make it unanimous, or you want to try one or two?
Tell me them again, because I've got to vet your every word, because sometimes the distinction can be so subtle. So tell me again.
This one's not subtle. This is either true or false, these
okay.
ones. So it's not going to be like 1-inch versus 3-inch kind of subtlety. Number one is scientists in Hawaii have discovered a new species of carnivorous caterpillar. Two is paleoanthropologists have discovered the first evidence of Neanderthal man in North America. And three, scientists have published the results of a key experiment demonstrating desktop cold fusion.
Desktop? They did do a recent study, maybe not too recent, maybe six months ago. They reassessed the cold fusion hubbub, the experiments, and it was still, they couldn't say 100% absolute nonsense. It was still some anomalous stuff that some people got. It wasn't. I was actually surprised that it wasn't a clear cut. 20 years later, this is still baloney. And really just put the final nail in the coffin. And it didn't come to that. But that was like 6 months ago. That's not recent, and I haven't seen anything. Neanderthal, God, I didn't think they got as far as North America. I mean, did the land bridge exist back then when they were...
30. Wow.
They told me the land bridge that connects essentially Siberia with Alaska
right.
across the Bering Strait. It comes and goes over the years with ice
yeah,
ages and whatnot.
Yeah, but wait, the Neanderthal did exist during the Ice Age, I think. So that's when it would have existed. But, I didn't see that. And cold fusion. You stink, Steve.
Everyone buys the carnivorous caterpillar, huh? You guys are just okay with that.
What? A caterpillar that eats a little meat, you know?
Yeah, it's a giant caterpillar, 24 feet long. But otherwise,
no,
it's totally,
that.
Totally normal.
No, that I mean, it's attacking Tokyo right now. All right, put your nickel down, Bob.
The cold fusion is just too obvious. There might be some subtle thing going on there that, I mean, something like we're going to have Mr. Fusion in the backs of our cars any day soon. I'm going to go with Neanderthal.
Okay. So let's dispense with the meat-eating caterpillar first. That is true.
Woohoo!
A newly named species of Hawaiian caterpillar eats snails. Which is probably the only thing slower than a caterpillar would be a snail. That's true. The name is Hypostmacoma molluscivora. The last one means it eats mollusks.
Isn't it?
Molluscivora. So, that one is true. That was presented to the University of Hawaii at Manoa. So now, which is it? Is it Neanderthal man or cold fusion, which is false? So let's talk about Neanderthal man. Neanderthal man was discovered, over 100 years ago in Europe. There are many, many fossil finds of Neanderthal man in Europe and the Middle East, as far as Asia and in North Africa. In fact, Neanderthal man probably originated in Africa. But there is, as yet, no evidence that Neanderthal man has ever ventured into North or South America, into the New World. That one I made up. That one is fake.
Okay.
So Bob wins this week. That is correct. It would be the first evidence if anyone did discover. I mean, it's not implausible. Neanderthal man migrated quite far. They had fire. They certainly were able to survive an ice age. There's no reason why they couldn't have crossed the Bering Strait into North America.
We just haven't found the evidence yet.
We don't know that they maybe they didn't. Maybe there was never a population living there when the Bering Strait was frozen over. But to date, there is no evidence that Neanderthal man has made it into North America. And Bob was confident that he would have heard that had that in fact occurred. So
all right,
number
Steve,
three.
If there's no evidence of Neanderthal man in North America, how do you explain our politics?
There's also no evidence that Neanderthal man ever crossbred with modern man. So that you can't rescue your hypothesis that way either, Perry.
Yeah, did they actually got their hands on? Was it some mitochondrial DNA or
some DNA from bone marrow from fossilized Neanderthal bones?
And it was pretty conclusive, right? That there was no commingling.
Right.
So you're going to tell me that cold fusion is real?
Well, listen, I what did I say? I said that I'll exactly read what I wrote.
Right.
Which is, scientists have published the results of a key experiment demonstrating desktop cold fusion. That's actually the title that I took from the news report. And I looked it up to make sure it was legitimate. But this is what happened. Researchers at Purdue University have published some new evidence supporting earlier findings. This is a replication of a study of a device that can produce nuclear fusion reactions. It does not actually produce energy yet. This is not a device that can produce a net output of energy. As opposed to the Pons and Fleischmann experiments, where they were basing it on the fact that they were finding an excess of energy in their apparatus.
Right.
This one is not defined by production of an excess of energy, but by other markers which are more reliable, like the hallmarks of nuclear fusion, which are, let me
neutrons?
Down here. The production of neutrons. And I think gamma radiation as well. What they do is they use sound waves to create...
Oh, sonoluminescence?
Yes, exactly, sonoluminescence. They basically create these bubbles, and the sound waves cause these bubbles to collapse very powerfully and very rapidly, which produces a very, very intense pressure and heat in a very, very microscopic, very tiny space, which is able to produce the forces required to, you know, cause some cold fusion to occur. It's certainly not yet a device that could be, again, we can't plug into this anytime soon to produce energy.
So it's cold fusion that doesn't actually do anything.
Well, it's a sort of a proof of concept, you know, sort of getting it to occur. So researchers have estimated that temperatures inside the imploding bubbles reach 10 million degrees Celsius, and pressure is comparable to 1 million Earth atmospheres at sea level. So I'm not sure if you can call 10 million degrees cold, but they're still calling it cold fusion, probably
that's kind of
because of that's the buzzword. And I think the researchers are just using nuclear fusion. In their more technical papers. I don't think they're really calling it cold fusion. But I guess the apparatus is cold. You don't have to produce an environment of these temperatures. But it's still which is, again, different than the Pons and Fleischmann sort of cold fusion claims. Inside these microscopic bubbles, you are creating a very small area of intense heat and pressure.
What was the basic flaw with Pons and Fleischmann? Why were they so wrong?
They probably were
experimental design, wasn't it?
Yeah, their methods weren't rigorous enough, and they had not eliminated all non-fusion sources of the excess energy that they were requiring. I'm not really sure of exactly what their methodological flaws were, but it came to light when basically every physics lab around the world tried to replicate their studies, and when you set up the experiment the same way they did it and run it the same way they did it, you did not get any evidence of cold fusion, no excess of energy. So they were doing something wrong. And that's why, you know, in science, replication is critical. If something works in your lab, you should be able to describe how you do it accurately enough that somebody following your procedure precisely should get the same results. And if they don't, then something's wrong.
And for some reason, they bypassed the peer review.
Yes, that was their historic error.
Right.
Rather than trying to submit their results to peer review and the process of vetting in the scientific community, they got so excited about their results and getting the Nobel Prize and being world famous and rich and all that stuff that they decided just to hold a press conference. And they basically became world famous boobs for doing that.
Oh, my God. essentially, well, I don't think you could say their careers are ruined, but, I mean, just saying Pons and Fleischmann, what do you think of? You think, oh, quacks.
That, they will forever define that phenomenon, just bypassing peer review and going to the press prematurely with a sensational claim that turns out not to be true. That is going to be what people will remember about them. It would be
legacy.
That's their legacy. I mean, it would be very, very difficult for them. They really would have to do something, you know, Watson and Crick-like in order to break out of that legacy. They're, you know, which is
it would still be mentioned.
It would still be a footnote.
You know, it reminds me. What's Nobel known for?
The Nobel Prize. Well, he makes dynamite, yeah.
Nobel Prize. Everyone would say Nobel Prize. It's just an interesting little aside, little story. I guess his brother died. Somebody with his name died. They thought it was him. He read his own obituary, and it said the man who invented dynamite. And he did not want that legacy. So because of that, he set up the whole Nobel Prize fund and gave it tons of money and set it up in perpetuity after he died. And now when anyone hears Nobel, they don't think dynamite. They think Nobel Prize.
That's true.
Some skeptics.
Yeah.
We know the truth.
That guy's nothing but a dynamite maker.
He thought dynamite was so powerful that it would essentially end, armed conflict, end wars. But of course, it just made him bigger and better and louder, and didn't end him. But he was kind of disappointed that it didn't have the anticipated effect.
Well, we have a guest this week, so let's move on at this time to our guest. We have with us tonight Stephen Salerno. Stephen is a author of the book SHAM, which is an acronym for the Self-Help and Actualization Movement, and subtitled How the Self-Help Movement Made America Helpless. Steve Salerno was a freelance feature writer, an essayist, and an investigative reporter. He writes on business, sports, and politics, and the wider social ramifications. His articles have appeared in Harper's, The New York Magazine, Esquire, Reader's Digest, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and other newspapers and journals. Steve, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
What's the genesis of SHAM, Steve? Where did it start?
I think that the American form, you had the Vietnam era was a pivotal time. It was a time of great social dislocation. You had young men who had plans for their lives being plucked out of their lives and sent over to die in a rice paddy, 5,000 miles away. And I think that at the same time this happened, you had a book come out called I'm Okay, You're Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And despite the optimism of the title, the basic message of this book was most of us ain't so okay, that there are things that happen to us early in childhood or as a result of our family socialization that make us the way we are and lay the groundwork for all sorts of problems. And I think that the publication of that book, and it was a colossal bestseller, and it became, a social ethos unto itself. The publication of that book in concert with the 60s Vietnam culture of just this total confusion and re-examining what are our values, I think that's what laid the groundwork for this sense of victimization, of being powerless in this hostile universe. And it really took 25, 30 years before a serious backlash came from the empowerment side.
Right. But it also sounds like what you're saying to some extent is this is a symptom of the fact that the hippies have grown up and are now ruling the world.
I think that's right. It's not just the hippies. It's the baby boom. In essence, you have an entire nation that is reaching midlife en masse.
Right.
And this explains why now, the interesting thing about self-help is that people are always predicting that it's peaked and it never has. Because, as you suggest, it's riding the curve of all of us Aquarians. I'm 55, and most of the people I know are somewhere between 35 and 65, and midlife being the time of reexamination that it is, everybody's always so hungry for, okay, where's my new path? How can I reinvent myself?
Right.
And the gurus know this, and that's why they tell us what they do.
And what they tell us is not what's good for us, but just exactly what we want to hear and what will sell.
Yeah, or they tell us something that is good for us, but it's expressed so generically, and that's by design, because if they gave us specific advice with a specific result, then they could be impeached on it when it doesn't happen.
Right.
So these people are, the people who really rise to the top in this movement are masters of treading that fine line between selling a message that seems actionable, but it really isn't. So there's no way you can go back to them and say, hey, I didn't get the results I thought I was going to get.
It's like vague, psychic predictions that are so.
It's
vague.
Literally that.
Exactly.
It's literally. No, I mean that quite. Sylvia Brown. Sylvia Brown now has become an iconic figure in self-help. She started out just the hardcore psychic stuff, and now she's gotten into this how my psychic insights are going to help you lead a more fulfilling life. And she is really, she's become dead mainstream in the movement now. She's not off on the spiritual fringe anymore. She's right there.
Well, Sylvia Brown and others have essentially started from the premise that the power of the mind is unlimited.
Well, you know, there are websites. There's a website. Yeah. I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but I think it's probably Outenhouse or Outenhouse. Mm-hmm. It's O-U-G-H-T-E-N. Their tagline on the site is, change your DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you're supposed to do this through the power of positive thinking. Now, it's sad, the number of people that want to believe something like that, but that's such a seductive message, this notion you can do it. You know, if you just learn how to get in touch with it, and let me teach you how, and here's my bill. You know,
right.
That's
right.
The message.
So, right, which is sort of the other thing, which is mind over matter. It's the
right.
idea that you can do anything with the power of your mind. You can alter reality. In a very real sense, and that's
or your DNA apparently.
Your well, any aspect of your DNA, your health, any problem that you have, it's basically just magical thinking. It sounds like.
Right. And remember, at some point down the road, you probably remember Uri Geller and the spoon bending and telekinesis
yes.
and a lot of
yes.
these things that were later
yes.
debunked.
But I've
heard
who it once
knows?
Or twice.
Even the people that I. That I interviewed from the real hardcore mainstream psychotherapy movement, they can see that there's a lot of terrain that's as yet unexplored in the human mind. So who knows what potential really is in there. But remember the premise of the book. What can we prove right now?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we compare that to these extreme messages being put out by the self-help gurus? And the bottom line is, right now, today, as we speak, there is no proof.
Right. And they, again, similar to alternative medicine, they basically bypass the whole proof thing, you know, doing scientific
That's right.
research and trying to, you know, have these ideas examined in a critical way. They just go straight to marketing. Somebody basically invents an idea out of whole cloth, writes an article or a book about it, creates an institute, markets it, and that's
right.
it. They're off and running without ever gathering any data to test their ideas.
But it's even worse than that because they're openly contemptuous of proof. They claim
yes.
that the very process of questioning it means you don't have the positive mental attitude that's going
mm-hmm.
to help you triumph. So
right.
you're not even allowed to have that crisis of faith.
Which is just a callous way to inoculate themselves against
Absolutely.
Disproof.
Sure.
I mean, I think
sure.
it's very calculated. I don't think it's innocent. And they also often will attack the experts that are in the best position to know that what they're saying is bunk.
Right, and then they have the mixed message, which, for example, there's a line I guess the best example I could use, there's Joe Jennings. Now, Joe Jennings is a former gangbanger and drug runner by his own admission. He wrote a book about it. He's been shot something like 13 times. He speaks to schools, and he talks to them about self-esteem, and he specializes in inner-city neighborhoods, which is the milieu that he came out of originally. And he tells these kids, he says, nothing can hold you back. You can do whatever you want. The sky's the limit. You can all be president, okay? That's the empowering
mm-hmm.
part of the message.
Mm-hmm.
But then he throws in the caveat, but if you can't do it, it's because of racism.
Right.
So which is it? And the
yeah.
funny thing is, you know, all of the kids applaud, so you can expect that from kids. But you have
yeah.
the administrators standing there, too, who are paying this guy, applauding and cheering. It's like, doesn't anybody add this stuff up and see the inherent contradictions?
That's interesting. It's kind of like the faith healers who say that you know, with faith you could be healed of anything. Of course, sometimes
right.
it doesn't work if your faith isn't strong enough.
That's right. That's
right.
because you weren't
right.
devout enough.
So there's always an escape hatch.
Yeah, well, Dr. Phil, who's as good a representative of the empowerment wing as anybody, in his diet book, in fact, the preface to it, he says that the diet book will help anyone who's really ready to embrace change.
Who's ready to embrace change.
Right.
right.
Which is the same slogan that AA was using for years and years, that we'll fix 75% of the people who are ready to embrace change.
who are ready.
Yeah, there's two things there. First of all, compare that to another realm. Like if you went to a surgeon and you wanted to know what your chances were, and he said to you, "Hey, I cure 75% of the people who don't die on my table."
Right.
You know, the first question might be, "Exactly how many is that we're talking about?" You know.
Right.
Yeah.
Why didn't they just go for 100%? If you're going to select only those, basically, if you're ready, if you improve, then we improved you, and if you don't improve, then it's your fault.
But in the case of AA, it's more serious than that again, because when you're talking about the people who, quote, are not ready to embrace change, there have been studies done of AA. They have to be done in sort of a very covert way, because AA has never cooperated with any investigation of its methods or its success rate.
Now, just for background, AA is
Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, it's not the Motor Club.
It's Alcoholics Anonymous, which is basically the original 12-step program.
I imagine your critiques of AA, Steve. I'm sorry. I imagine your critiques of AA have drawn some very harsh comments your way.
Oh, you should see my inbox and the inbox that's connected up to my website. And the funny thing is, you'll get these rationalizations that say, look, if I think it works for me, it doesn't matter if I'm still drinking.
That's right.
It's like, excuse me?
Right.
And again, it's that same paradox. But just to get back to and finish the point about AA, when you talk about the people who are not ready to embrace change, estimates are that as many as 90% of the people who go to the first meeting and or go to the second meeting do not show up for the third. So there's an enormous attrition rate by every measure that's ever been used. So even if they do fix 75% of the people who are ready, and I'm dubious about that, that there's a vastly larger universe of people that they don't even connect with in the first place. And when you're talking about a problem that costs America $185 billion each and every year in direct costs and lost productivity, we need to know what works.
Right, absolutely. And the studies show that AA is no better than just quitting cold turkey, than just going on your own and just deciding that you're going to stop drinking.
Right. It would have been nice to be able to have truly controlled studies where the same universe was being tested by the same controlled conditions in the same study. We don't have that simply because AA won't cooperate.
Right.
But the largest retrospective studies that have been done at the National Institutes of Health appear to show that you have at least as good a chance if you just try to quit on your own, and you almost certainly have a better chance if you indulge in traditional psychotherapy plus some of the newer chemical interventions like naltrexone, which, again, AA has actively fought the implementation of.
Yeah. Now, the antabuse type of drugs, the drugs that essentially, if you drink alcohol while you're taking them, you have a very nasty side effect. So it gives you a physiological disincentive to drink. There's good evidence to show that they are, in fact, extremely effective, more effective, certainly, than AA.
Right, I have kind of the same reaction when I watch Oprah.
Right,
I get that extreme physical reaction, you know. But she's been a kingmaker in the movement. So I guess I far be it for me to talk.
Now, would you consider Oprah to be the queen of sham?
The king?
That's good. I should have used that in the book. Well, certainly the road to self-help success leads through Harpo Productions. There's four people that I profile in one part of the book. Three of them. They owe their careers to Oprah. The day before they appeared on her show and the day after they appeared on her show was two different worlds for them. And I think that's true of many people who have some sort of self-help product to sell, particularly if it's in book form. And of course, Oprah herself actively sings that message, this notion that you can change your life, that you can be so much more than you ever thought you could be. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's no tactical component. There's no way to translate that into an action plan, and that's really the biggest weakness in a lot of this stuff that's churned out every year.
Again, we are talking with Stephen Salerno, author of Sham, How the Self-Help Movement Made America Helpless. A very, very interesting book, an entertaining read. I know Evan has been just tearing the book up. Tell us what you've read.
Yeah, I've had the pleasure of going through this book and reading a lot of things. Steve, right in the introduction here, I mean, one sentence that we were just really having a hoot with earlier here. One sentence. For a while during the 1980s, a company called Potentials Unlimited was selling subliminal audio tapes to cure deafness.
Yeah, the thing that struck me about that, when I came across that fact, it was fairly late in my research that I came across that. And the funny thing is I made a conscious decision early in the going that I was going to talk about programs that really just worked on your psyche as opposed to tangible products. Because if you get into tangible products, you know, like Stairmasters and stuff like that, then anything can be considered self-help. But I couldn't resist this one, because if there is any single line or product that summarizes the absolute contempt for the consumer,
right,
that is built into so much self-help. That's it, selling audio tapes
to the deaf. It's like videotapes for the blind, right?
And this is the thing, is that these, so many of these men and women think they're the Teflon gurus, you know, that it doesn't matter how outrageous they get. I'll give you another example that dates to just yesterday. I get an email in my inbox from Tony Robbins, of all people.
Hello.
Well, yep. No, it's not quite as special as that because, see, I had registered for his discussion boards back when I was researching the book because I wanted to see the kind of stuff that went back and forth among the members.
Sure.
So now he's spamming everybody in his community to sell these this new product that he's got that teaches you how to keep the marriage, how to keep the magic in your marriage, or how to keep the love alive and prevent the embers from going, you know, whatever. And just the irresistible thing about this is that at this very moment, Tony is finishing up a trial in Canada, which revolves around the circumstances under which he unburdened himself of wife one in order to hook up with wife two, who apparently had been married to someone else round about the time, you know, we're not sure of the exact chronology here, but clearly it was a fairly efficient switch from one to the other. And there again, this has been making a lot of news. I mean, anybody who does a news search on Tony Robbins, anybody who Googles him, you're going to get this trial. And all of the allegations about, you know, how he came to be rid of wife one and on to wife two, and yet he's spamming people with this message at exactly this time that this trial is reaching its climax.
It is incredible.
And it's just like, it's this mentality, no one can touch me.
Yeah, but don't you think they're justified in thinking that? Because the history has shown that you can basically sell ridiculous products and ideas, and the public will, by and large, enough of them will buy it.
Yeah, well, I forget whether it was the New York Times Book Review or Publishers Weekly, but to use the word Teflon again, they called self-help publishing the Teflon category because it seems that no matter what state the economy is in, people are going to buy these books. They're going to pre-order the next Dr. Laura book, even if they had to cut down on their budget for milk or whatever the case may be. They're going to buy these books, and the thing is, they have to believe. It's a compulsion. Mm-hmm. They will not accept your logic simply because it flies in the face of their need to believe, no matter how absurd the belief.
Can I quote Benjamin Franklin when he said, "There are no greater liars in the world than quacks, except for their patients."
Except for their patients.
Except for their patients.
That's good. That's good.
Right. It's true. I mean, would you say it's fair that your rank and file self-help guru is a con artist to some degree? What would you say about that?
Well, you know, let's put it, I think that there is some degree of sincerity. There was a kernel of sincerity in most of the larger people who started out in this field. But I think what happens is, they start believing their own PR. They see this tremendous money-making machine that it is. And it's again, it's the untouchable syndrome. They realize that they have this huge captive audience like Dr. Phil. Or a better example would be John Gray. Now, John Gray, there are serious... John Gray is Mars and Venus. Okay, there are serious questions about whether he even has the credentials to be talking to people about human relations and psychotherapy issues.
Credentials?
His credentials... Exactly.
Well, he's a doctor, isn't he?
No.
he's a scientist.
This book, let me point out, this book was very carefully legally vetted by Random House's lawyers, and I had to prove a lot of stuff. But, you know, like John Gray, he's got one degree from a diploma mill. The college was later shut down by the state of California. He's got his advanced, quote-unquote, degree is from the world-famous Maharishi University. And he spent, now this is a guy, if you read Mars and Venus in the Bedroom, he spends a lot of time giving people the most precise step-by-step formats for foreplay. If she does this, you do that. If she shows up in blue lingerie, it means this. If the lingerie is pink, it means that. This guy, for all intents and purposes, was a celibate monk for 8 years before he hit upon this formula. Is that the guy that you want to take foreplay advice from?
He had a lot of time to think about it, obviously.
There you go. But again, to finish the point, so not only do we know that he's really qualified to be doing that, But now he's doing diet, nutrition, and exercise, where he has no competency.
Everyone feels like they're competent to give dieting and nutrition advice.
Yeah, even Oprah.
Anybody. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any criteria necessary except that you eat occasionally.
Oh, and they make stuff up. Again, you know, it's not quite on the same order as the audio tapes to cure deafness, but Tony Robbins, at a critical part of his seminars, will talk about the importance of nutrition as it relates to achieving your potential, and he talks about the energy frequency of foods and mm-hmm. how critical this is. There's no such thing.
Energy frequency of foods.
Yeah, there's no such thing documented. I went to the top. I thought maybe this is some esoteric thing I never heard of. He made it up. He made it up because it sounds good and proprietary.
Now, you see, I agree.
That word's a red flag.
Energy, yeah, energy definitely is that. That's a buzzword. A lot of nutrition's a buzzword. Empowerment's a buzzword. I mean, they use a lot of the words that sell, basically. Now, I understand that, you know, we can't read minds. You don't know how much people believe their own BS. And oftentimes, no matter what you come up with, you will get so much positive feedback. It's not hard to think that you're onto something, just because, you know, if you give people almost anyone who comes to you for advice or reads a book or article for advice is probably, no matter what you say, there is a certain psychological phenomenon at work where they're probably going to feel like they were helped to some degree. Just the fact that they're thinking about their life will make, and they feel like there's somebody who understands them, will make them feel better. So people, you know, the gurus do get a lot of positive feedback no matter what nonsense they're spouting. But when you come out with things like the frequency of food, I'm sorry, that guy knows it's BS. He made that up because it sells. You just can't convince me that he has any belief in that nonsense.
Right, but again, I want to, not that I'm trying to nitpick you here during the show, but let's be careful about the distinction between, you said people come out of this feeling better. I think it's critical that we make a distinction between feeling better
and thinking they feel
better. Yeah. To make somebody feel better about a situation that needs to be changed is not the same as changing the situation.
That's right. Again,
one of my key gripes about self-help is that it actually encourages stasis. People think that if they keep reading and thinking and thinking and reading and occasionally going to the seminars, that becomes the replacement for the action that would actually make a difference. Like, instead of all that, why don't you go get your damn plumber's license and be done with it, you know, and at least you'll have a trade. I mean,
no, I agree. Again, I didn't mean to imply that people are actually helping this. It's more like a placebo effect but it's good to clarify that they will report that they're better even when they're not. Even as people are dying, they think, this is helping me.
That is true. I'm dying happily.
Yeah. I've had patients get absolute pseudoscientific quack treatments for diseases, and I examine them, and they're doing horribly. And they tell me, you know, thank goodness I got this treatment. I'm doing so much better on it. But by every objective outcome or assessment, they're doing worse. So there's just some psychological aspect. It's a psychologist would call it, at least one part of it is risk justification. If you spend the money on the seminar, you want to feel like it was worthwhile. So you will report and believe that it helped you, even if you're feeling worse, even if you're doing worse, even if you're still drinking. You spent all this time, all this emotional investment, all this money. It damn well better have helped you.
And that's actually a very savvy observation, because it applies in corporate America too. You will see that companies, training managers who approve the check request for the $50 or $100,000 that gets paid to a sports motivator, instead of having somebody come in who can actually teach tactical skills, they feel that they have to document that something was accomplished.
Right.
And so you will see in the follow-up things like, I see a better spirit of camaraderie. Or these sort of vague, soft-sided improvements. You never see things like sales jump 17.6%, because that does not happen.
Their sort of guilty endorsement gets used as a sales pitch for the next sale, right?
Right.
Say, well, look, this company thought that this was wonderful and it helped them.
Right. Meetings Professionals International. I'm sorry, guys, it's late, but MPI. They did a study 2 years ago where they asked training managers, would you rather have somebody like a Tommy Lasorda come in Or would you rather have somebody come in who's a real hardcore tactician to train your people? And when that was the way the choice was presented, either or, 81% went for the Tommy Lasorda type, mm-hmm. which to me is an astonishing stat. The idea that even at the upper echelons of corporate America, people would rather have this raw, formless, rah-rah cheerleading mm-hmm. than actually learning skills. It's an incredible comment on the direction the society is going in, I think.
Yeah, I think there's a culture of self-help which is sort of taking on a life of its own, but it's also some basic human psychology. People would rather have the magic, easy answer to the complex problems than rather the answer being, which is almost always the case, well, it's a lot of hard work. There's no easy road or easy answers. It's going to be a difficult analysis and just basically a hard, detailed work all along. People don't want to hear that because it's hard work.
Or there's no money for it, which is one of the reasons. There's a number of reasons, and I spend a whole chapter on it. But the self-esteem movement in American education, particularly in inner-city neighborhoods where a lot of the schools were just falling apart at the seams, it would have taken too much money and too much work to actually address the infrastructure needs and completely revamp the curricula and just take a whole different approach. But it was relatively easy to simply say, why don't we do this? Why don't we have an assembly every other Tuesday and have the kids come in and sing about how special they are? You know, that was a lot easier. And then what we'll do is we'll give them a pizza party every month for perfect attendance. But an interesting thing happened, which was that they weren't getting perfect attendance even for a month. So they said, well, let's do this. Let's call it perfect attendance if they show up 4 days out of five. So you see what they're doing is...
near perfect attendance. Right.
Yeah, they're dumbing everything down to the point where everybody can qualify for it. And you and I both know that is not real self-esteem. Mm-hmm. That's a Mickey Mouse micromanaged, contorted version of self-esteem that really does not help anybody achieve any real success.
That's right. Yeah, because if people don't feel like they earned it, if they feel like it was everyone wins, you know, then people know that that's worthless. And
well, you know, I teach college still, and I get students who come to me, and they're doing C+ work. I'm a nice guy. I'll give them a B-, you know, if they participated. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, hey, you know, Professor Salerno, you can't give me a B- because I'm pre-med. And I'm thinking, well, how's that my problem? I mean, maybe you should have worked a little harder, you know? But they're so used to having the track greased for them all the way through that when they run up against a standard that's the slightest bit inflexible, they crash.
Right. Would you say that's entitlement culture? And do you think that there's a relationship between the entitlement culture and the sort of victim culture and also the sort of self-help empowerment culture? How do you see those societal factors working together?
Well, a really good example is a couple of lawsuits in Pennsylvania right now where you have students who are learning disabled who are suing the colleges that they could not graduate from for not being better at helping them graduate and preparing them to enter the workforce. Now, you see, if this was just quote-unquote regular students, and I'm not saying anything disparaging about being learning disabled, but the fact is I think objectively, there are questions about why a learning disabled person who cannot, by his own admission, read or add simple columns of numbers, why is this person allowed to be in college in the first place? And why is it the college's job to ameliorate all of the inherent problems this person brings to the table? And so there's nothing more dramatic that you see in American society today than where the self-pity of victimization beats up against the sense of entitlement of empowerment, because then there's no end to what this person expects.
Right. And it's the empowerment, entitlement, if you will, is almost to the point where it's like not only does everyone deserve to be, you know, quote unquote normal, everyone deserves to be above average. And even, you know, in the extreme end of the spectrum, you know, everyone deserves to be godlike in their power over reality. And if you suggest that, you know, well, perhaps maybe, you know, we all can't be above average or godlike in our power, then you're mean in some way.
You see, what you have now is the exact converse of that situation we had about 20 years ago where everybody was dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
Now everybody is hyperfunctional.
Right.
So we all live in Lake Wobegon. You know, we're all way above average. And you obviously can't govern a society like that because at some point you have to make value judgments about who gets what.
So, Steve, I was telling some people at work today that we're going to be interviewing you tonight for our podcast. Explain to them what your book is and a little bit about it and what I've read. And the first question I got from one of my cohorts at work was, well, what about the people like Tony Robbins who actually do really make a difference, a real tangible difference in just one person's life? Doesn't that mean, therefore, it's worth it in the end? What do you think of that? I'm sure that's not the first time you've heard
Let me throw this back to you. If cardiac bypass surgery cured one person and killed the other 5 million each year, is that worth it? Is that worth an investment?
Yeah, right.
You're talking about an $8.5 billion industry, soon to be a $12 billion, and that's just the tip of the iceberg because a lot of this is underground economy stuff. I think that when you're talking about the kinds of outlays that we're talking about, that it behooves us to know what works and not just to rely on anecdotal evidence. Because as you guys know, I interviewed people who swore they'd been healed by distant prayer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where's the clinical validation for any of this? And
right.
I think another aspect of it, just because somebody says it works for all the reasons we've already covered, doesn't mean it really worked for them. They might
right.
think it worked. They might have to believe it worked. They might not be able to face the fact that it didn't work, but that doesn't mean it worked.
That's one of the hardest tangible
evidence.
Or they could be out and out lying.
I suppose that's possible, but I'm inclined to think that I'm not saying, you can accidentally do the right thing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's possible that somebody can go to a Tony Robbins seminar or even get off the air with Dr. Laura, and there can be something that happens that's good after that. But that, first of all, you know, the old a priori reasoning, just because it happened after doesn't mean that Tony or Dr.
Right.
Laura was the catalyst. And even if it did happen, that's one person. That means nothing.
Right. And often the self-help gurus will wrap their message around some pretty common sense, everyday wisdom. You know,
right.
like it's better to be a good person than to be a jerk. You know, some really basic concepts that anybody would identify as reasonable wisdom. So if somebody who really wasn't even thinking about how they go, they have no insight into their life or what they're doing, mm-hmm. and then you're giving them some basic rules of thumb about how to live your life. Again, it's not
right.
it's not inconceivable that can have a positive impact. But we have to look at the net effect, the risk versus the benefit, and the cost effectiveness, right? Is this really worth
right.
$8 billion a year? Maybe we could be spending that money a little bit better somewhere else.
Right, and even on an individual basis, is it cost effective for any one individual?
Right.
And then you have, we have the things that we think are innocuous, like I call it sports think in the book, but I went to an hour-long presentation by Tommy Lasorda, who is one of the leading seminar speakers. He got $50,000 to deliver this speech. The entire speech, so far as I could determine, reduced to, you gotta want it. In other words, that's his essential message.
I'll do that now, for $20,000.
There you go. Now Tommy says something else, too, though, because I think we should just think about this briefly. Tommy says the guy who wins is the guy who wants it the most. That's that kind of fire and brimstone
yeah.
spiel that you hear a lot of coaches deliver. If you
right.
really want it, you'll go out and win. Well, think about that for a minute. What does that say about the guy who loses?
Right. That's
right.
It says he didn't want it. And I
right.
think that I interviewed like Bob Rotella. He's a leading sports psychologist. To indoctrinate that kind of message in impressionable young kids, like on let's say high school baseball or football teams, they're not fully developed. They don't know how to deal with all this psychological stuff. And you tell a kid like that, if you lose this game, in effect, what you're telling him, you lose this game, it means you didn't want it.
Means it's your fault. Right.
Yeah, exactly. That you blew it for us. And I think that whatever good you can achieve by making people strive, there has to be some bad that you achieve by selling that kind of a guilt trip.
Right. Well, there's got to be some balance to it. I mean, sometimes you try your best, but the other
right.
guy was just better, or the fortunes did not blow your way, and
right.
and you may still lose or not succeed, and that's okay.
You know, when I played college football, we had one of those fire and brimstone coaches, and he was going, we had a particularly bad first half, and we'd been missing blocks left and right, and he lined us up all against a wall in a gym, and he's getting in our faces, are you ever going to miss another, you know, fill in the expletive block? And he's going down the line, and of course, the only acceptable answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was too analytical for that, So when he got to me, I said, well, I'm going to try not to, but the odds are I will at some point.
That made him thrilled, I'm sure.
Yeah, now that is a common sense, true to life answer, but that answer in many settings is simply not acceptable. Mm-hmm. It's not it's a logical answer, but it's not an acceptable answer.
Not to a sports coach. That's
there
for
you
sure.
Go.
Now, getting back to the whole risk versus benefit, and again, it's important not to underestimate or to miss the real harm that the self-help things can do. What that reminds me of one particular instance after 9/11. The grief counselors sort of descended on New York City. And I remember reading that, you know, after the fact that they sort of did an assessment of what the impact of the grief counselors were. And in fact, people who had had grief counseling were worse off than people who were just left to their own devices.
Right.
Do you recall that?
Yeah, the classic story. I interviewed Sally Satel, who has a book out now about what she calls therapism, the rise of, you know, the notion that everything that happens that makes you even the least bit sad needs to be treated somehow through grief counseling. And she talked about this situation where they brought grief counselors into schools after 9/11, and they descended on the kids and were so in their face about this that there were actually kids saying after a while, okay, can I just go color now? You know, like, they really, you know how kids are. They're pretty resilient, even when some truly horrible things happen. But you're right. This notion that you should feel bad makes you feel bad after a while. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
There are lots of self-fulfilling prophecies. I'm reminded of the repressed memory syndrome movement.
Right.
I was going to add, do you cover that in the book, Steve?
Yes, I do. I talk about the fact that this I trace to being a part of victimization. When you had so many people persuaded that they were so screwed up because of something that happened to them in childhood, and then when you have compliance psychology, you know, that became an industry. I mean, diagnosing sexual abuse in children became a cottage industry within the psychological profession. So when you have people who are trained to kind of extract this out of you, we saw this societal phenomenon where suddenly people were turning in their neighbors, kids were turning in their coaches. It got completely out of hand.
Their parents.
It became a witch hunt. Became a witch
Absolutely.
Hunt. Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that phenomenon, the repressed memory syndrome, again, which is the basic idea that traumatic events from our youth are repressed and then they manifest in our adult life or later life as eating disorders or anxiety or psychological problems. So, and the promoters of this idea, you know, believe that 50-60% of all women were raped as children or abused as children, just some ridiculous number. And they essentially preach that, you know, if a 15-year-old girl walks into your office and she has an eating disorder, she was abused as a child, and it's your job to drag that out of her. So essentially, they just came up with some idea about what was going on. They never subjected to any kind of testing or scientific study. They wrote the books, you know, started the institute, started spreading the word, and they essentially were manufacturing a problem that didn't exist. They were creating a problem by basically instilling in their clients false memory syndrome. We actually had to come up with a name for what they were doing to these people. And the harm reverberated throughout their entire family and often their community. I mean, there are parents in jail for years because of accusations that were essentially made through recovered memories. Really scary stuff.
Well,
I think
that phenomenon to finally die out? What was the final?
I think it was just a lot of it was debunked, and I think a lot of cases were overturned on appeal as a result of overzealous prosecution, and some, especially in dealing with children. There was one famous case, the name escapes me, where they got hold of the original interview tapes and they played them, and they saw what the interviewers had actually done to implant these memories
as opposed
to just extracting them. And that was the start of the prosecutor was fired. There were all kinds of lawsuits, and I think a new era of reason was restored to some degree.
And it was, you know, as much as I hate to admit this, a lot of it was driven by the fact that former clients were turning around and suing their therapists for instilling these false memories. So it was really the threat of lawsuit that I think turned the tide against the repressed memory syndrome. But it's still out there. It still exists. These things never go away entirely. They only become marginalized to some degree.
And I think the larger point here, it's kind of like Tony Robbins with his energy frequency and what you were saying about, you know, this automatic assumption. Somebody walks in who's anorexic, you know, bingo, child abuse. it's the positing of these things as fact that have no foundation at all, and they're said with such authority. Dr. Phil, you know, to kind of make it a more pop culture ring to it, he has this line in his book Relationship Rescue. Your relationship is in trouble because you set it up that way. Now, incidentally, for Dr. Phil, that's an awfully victimization-based thought, you know. But it was convenient for that point in the book. It made for a very sexy opening. But again, that's so simplistic. I mean, it allows no room for unforeseen circumstances, for quote unquote growing apart, or any of the other environmental factors that can play havoc with relationships. And that's the sort of oversimplistic, straight line, completely unfounded thinking that handicaps the sham movement from start to finish.
But so, makes it very profitable.
Yeah, exactly.
You bet.
So what's the solution, if there is any? I mean, what do rational, reasonable people do to, you know, to help themselves against this, their friends, their family, the culture at large? What's there to be done?
Yeah, this is another thing that I've taken a lot of hits for in the emails that people send me and some of the postings on this new blog that I started to try to get a give and take going on this subject. But they say, well, if you're going to take the hope away from us, you got to give us something. And I didn't feel that that was my mandate in this book. I feel that we live in a culture where you are so immersed in this, you can't escape it. You know, the plots of movies have self-help elements embedded. It's in your personnel policy manual at work. It's on Oprah. This book was written as a rebuttal. And, you know, just sort of like, look, there may be another side here. Let's think about this. That's really the tone of the book. And originally in my proposal, I did have an appendix. And the title of the appendix was Where to Go for Real Help. And we decided at the end, my editor and I, to ditch that because we didn't want the book to be perceived as our own self-help book.
Right.
You know, thinly, you know, masquerading as an expose.
Yeah, that would diminish your message.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I think it's going to sell less because of that, to be honest, because I think there's people out. I think that there are more people who would read the book, who really need to read the book, if I gave them something, and I don't. I give them nothing. All I give them is analysis throughout the book. But
I think, I mean, you are giving people something. You're giving them critical thinking and insight and doubt, which is, those are all good things, but they're perceived of as negative.
And
I think we, you know, again, of course, in the skeptical movement, we deal with that all the time. We're taking away people's beliefs and their cherished beliefs, and what are we giving them in return? Well, we're giving you, you know, some critical thinking. We're giving
you know what the
reason
irony
and rationality.
Is? The irony is what you are giving them, although I almost hate to say this because it sounds Dr. Phil-ish, but you are giving them real empowerment, but they don't realize it because
they're
not used to dealing with that. They're not used to dealing with the empowerment that involves critical thinking. They're used to dealing with this
magical
formless, push-button empowerment.
And that's how we do try to sell it, you know, that skepticism is a good protection against being conned yourself. As we like to jokingly say, you know, skeptics never get abducted, never get haunted. there's a lot of advantages to it, but it's not, as you say, it's not push button empowerment. It takes a lot of thought and work and reading, you know, and it's a long, slow, difficult process, but those are the only ones that have actual, real, valuable rewards at the end.
Right. It takes facing up to the fact that some of the things that have gotten you through that are crutches, you're going to have to leave those by the wayside.
Right.
But I really do think that the long-term benefit is more of a genuine sense of self-esteem, of having looked at the landscape what's out there and having really decided what's best for you instead of having somebody else preach it at you.
And change is painful. So people are scared of change. So
absolutely.
Again, they'd rather listen to the person who's peddling easy answers than hear the real answers, which is you've got a lot of painful hard work ahead of you if you really want to make some serious improvements and fix these very deeply embedded problems. Or even sometimes I think it's just as simple that people need to have some sense of meaning in their life. And I think that's probably at the core of most of the midlife crisis, as you were discussing earlier, is just some sense of meaning. And I think the whole New Age spirituality movement is all about that. It's just here's some instant meaning we're going to impart onto your life. And that is so tempting. People have such a deep desire for that. I think there's always going to be a market for meaning.
Yeah, I had an anecdote in the book that we finally cut at the end about my mother. My mother was one of these people who was so convinced she was going to win big in Vegas that she actually factored the money into her budget. And, of course, she never won because people like my mother never do. But she kept going and she kept saying, you know, just like a good little affirmation girl, she would say, I'm going to win $500 and I'm going to this. And the irony was that in the 3 years that she went to Vegas and made all these plans for all this money, all she did was lose thousands and thousands of dollars. And I kept saying to her, Mom, if instead of going to Vegas, you just took the money you would have blown in Vegas, you could have paid for some of those trips you thought you were going to go on with the money from Vegas. And,
right.
And that's the point of realization a lot of people never get to.
Right. It's like if you actually invested all the money you used to buy lotto tickets throughout your life in a mutual fund, you know.
That's right.
By the time you got to like 50 or by the time you retired, you actually have a nice little nest egg there.
Oh, right? or if you talk about the real hardcore Tony Robbins junkies who are spending maybe $8,000-$10,000 a year to go to his various off-site shindigs. I mean, that's serious money now.
You could certainly put that to much better use.
Yep.
Well, have you investigated at all or written much about in your book the sort of self-help cults like Est and I think Mindspring is another one where you go beyond just peddling easy answer to really sucking people into a completely different life?
Yeah, we do have a short treatment of Est. You know, there's a cultish aspect to a lot of self-help, and this is really one of the ironies of seeking self. If you think about it, if you have a stadium with 12,000 people in it, and you're all standing at exactly the same instant and chanting the same exact phrases, and you learn to parrot these things, like if you read the Tony Robbins discussion boards, you will see that people speak in these same Tony Robbins buzzwords and these same affirmations. How is that finding self?
Right.
If you think about it, what you're all doing is you're finding this all-purpose cloned version of Tony is what you're really finding.
Right.
And I think that is, there's definitely a cultish aspect to
Absolutely.
That, even if it isn't formally a cult.
Yeah, well, I mean, cults are not black and white. You know,
they're, right.
Those who have written about cults usually outline 15 or 20 different characteristics that
right.
cults have. And the more of those you have, the more of a cult you are. Some of the ones
right.
that a lot of these self-help movements have, as you allude to, are a sort of an internal jargon. So use certain buzzwords, and that's how you identify each other. You know,
right.
if you
right.
And it's all, it also separates you from sort of the rest of the world.
And the,
you have your own code language.
Right. Another thing I'm uncomfortable with in many of the self-help programs is that there's a multi-level aspect, a certain evangelism, which the idea being that you either get discounts for bringing in new people, or that you're supposed to go out and spread the gospel. And, you know, that again to me, I get queasy when I hear that, because that again is reminiscent of the Jim Jones syndrome, you know. Soon we'll all be drinking the Kool-Aid.
Right. Well, I think we're almost out of time. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about your book or about the self-help movement that we didn't delve into?
Well, the only real thing I would say at this point, and this sounds sort of self-evident, but maybe this is a little element of hope or at least a program, is to please be, I would exhort people to please be a little bit more credential conscious than we tend to be. Just the fact that somebody hangs out a shingle that says life coach does not make it so. I interviewed an executive who was making $600,000 a year, who was taking life coaching and swore by it, and it turned out when I followed up on it that the person he was taking life coaching from had run an ice cream business up to 2 months before then.
Right.
Now, it's possible maybe that guy could have done him some good, but what are the odds? And in any case, you know, had he known all this, which he didn't know, would he have selected that person? So be credential conscious, and if you're going to embark on therapy, make it legitimate therapy. You know, even under the most controlled circumstances, you're seeing a therapist in an office setting 1, 2, 3 hours a week. Psychologists will admit that 6 months, a year down the road, for some people it still doesn't take. Nothing really changes. But
right.
at least you gave it an honest try. You're not going to get it from Dr. Laura or Dr. Phil.
Right. I think the bottom line rule of thumb is if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And in this realm, You know, what that means is there's no easy answers.
That's right.
People are complex. We are complex entities, and we have complex psychology and relationships
right.
and sociology. And, you know, if you have real serious problems, I don't think there is any, as you say, there's no push-button solution. So
right, and I think that when you're dealing with an uncharted realm like the mind, I think it's important to at least consider the idea that if it hasn't been shown to have a proven benefit, it's probably not worth the risk of what it might do to you on
right.
the dark side. So
these things are not harmless, so you have to consider the potential harm.
Absolutely.
Distracting you from real solutions, the financial cost, the diversion of your time and
right,
attention.
Right.
You know, maybe you should spend that money taking your wife out to dinner rather than
right,
analyzing the color of her dress.
if there is a one overriding message to the book you just hit on it, this is not benign. This is not
mm-hmm.
silly. This is serious stuff, and it deserves to be treated accordingly.
Amen.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for being on
thank
the Skeptic's
you.
Guide. It was a great conversation. We appreciate having you.
Thank you, Steve.
And again, for the listeners, you can go visit Steve Salerno's website, www.journalismpro.com. And from your website, there's a link to Amazon where you can buy your book, Sham.
Right, and there's also a blog. It's a link to a blog for anybody who wants to attack me or tell me why I'm dead wrong. I'd be more than happy to read what you write and respond to it.
Well, thanks again. That's
Thank
it
you.
For this week. Thanks again for listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information on this and other episodes, see our website at www.thenes.com.